Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last night, I saw a movie called The Fall. It's a kind of fantasy, adventure, magical realism thing from 2006, apparently. But it had some really interesting music, opening with Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, and including something that was pretty clearly based on a famous piece of Balinese music. Anyway, at one point, the little girl in the film is told by an older man that if she's scared, she should say the magic words. Googly, googly, googly. And I thought, how funny that words, or just sounds, become magic just because we repeat them. Like Bloody Mary. You know, you're supposed to say Bloody Mary 3 times in front of a mirror, and this ghost is supposed to appear. Or rabbit, 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 which is an old English superstition. Just repeating the word rabbit is supposed to bring you good luck. Well, as luck would have it, our live band on Soundcheck today is Rabbit, Rabbit. They only say it twice, but it's been working for them. We'll talk about their online subscription series and the new album that it just spawned. Speaking of movies, there's a new documentary playing this week here in New York called Iceberg Slim, Portrait of a Pimp. Iceberg Slim basically started the street-lit style back in the 70s, writing a series of black urban crime novels, all very pulpy and all fairly influential. In fact, the actor and rapper Ice-T took his name as a kind of homage to Iceberg Slim and produced this new documentary. Well, now the street-lit crew is a little bit bigger, thanks to another well-known rapper.
There's a war going on outside, no man is safe from. Could run, but you can't hide forever from these streets that we done took. You walking with your head down, scared to look. You shook.
Most people know Albert Prodigy Johnson as a rapper and half of the hip-hop duo Mobb Deep. But now we're about to see a new side of Prodigy, his fiction writing. Prodigy, welcome to Soundcheck.
How you doing?
Good. Your novella is called HNIC.
Yeah.
Which sort of links directly to a trio of records that you've done over the years.
Yes.
How close is the link? I mean, is it all of a piece for you, this story and those records?
Actually, no, but it is linked in a way, though. The book was actually a movie script that I wrote when I made my first HNIC album back in 2000. I wrote the movie to go along with it, but I never got a chance to shoot the movie. So the script has just been sitting around for bunch of years.
Ah.
So I decided, you know, to put it out as a book first now.
So you got this British author, Stephen Saville, to work with you on, and so now it's a novella. So
it's a novella.
It's a quick read.
Short read.
And it's called HNIC, which could stand for Head Noodle in Charge if N stood for noodle, which it doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's on the infamous imprint. So again, you've got this connection to your infamous record label.
Right.
How different is it writing a screenplay, an autobiography, and an album full of lyrics? Are they three very different processes?
Well, the autobiography is a little more close to the music, because the music that I make is, you know, with my group also, Mobb Deep, the music that we make is more like, we call it reality rap. We talk about a lot of real situations and our life. We put our life in the music. So the autobiography is something like that. But we don't really do fiction too much in the music. You know, we try to stay away from that. So writing a fiction novella was definitely something new for me. Something that I like to do, though, because it gives me a chance to, you know, use my imagination and my creativity more.
Well, now, the key character in the novella, HNIC, is Pappy, who, you know, he's like a low-level street thug, but he's got a brain in his head, and he wants to get out. he keeps finding himself in situations where he's holding a gun in his hand. Right. And while he's not actually shooting anybody in the story, this continues to, like, pull him into really bad situations.
Yeah, Pappy's one of the main characters in the book. He grew up, you know, in a bad neighborhood in the projects in Brooklyn. And, you know, he's pretty much a good kid, but, you know, he grew up a hard life, you know what I mean? He tries to take himself out of that life and put himself into computer school and do more positive things with himself. And then his old friends from the neighborhood call him back. Like, they trick him, really. They trick him to come back, and he comes back, and, you know, he ends up getting involved with these guys again.
Right. Yeah. So Black is the HNIC. He's the guy who's ostensibly in charge.
Yeah.
So Pappy has grown up in the Brooklyn projects. You grew up in the projects in Queens. Pappy can't get away from guns. You did time on a gun possession charge. So how much of this writing, you said it was fiction, but how much of it is kind of related to your own personal experience?
The only way I would say is related is that, you know, how I try to transform my life, how I did transform my life to doing something more positive with myself. You know, coming from the street environment where I come from, you know, and then going into hip-hop music, that was a positive step for me. Mm-hmm. But then even that, you know, the hip-hop music that we do is very, you know, street-related, is very rugged, and we deal with a lot of unsavory characters, you know what I mean, out there. So, it's kind of hard, you know, to get away from that, especially at a young age. You know what I mean? We were very young when we came into the business. We were like 15, 16 years old.
Wow.
So we were just like young juvenile delinquents, you know, trying to do something good, but at the same time caught up in that lifestyle. So it took me a while. I had to learn, you know, to take myself out of certain situations, and put myself in the right circle of people that, you know, are doing positive things like I'm trying to do in my life.
So now the autobiography that you released not too long ago, and the most recent record, Albert Einstein, that you did with The Alchemist, were those both begun while you were serving time in prison?
Actually, Albert Einstein was just recently made. I would say we made that music, the whole album, it took us about 6 months. Like in the past, I would say 8 months, the album was created, the whole thing. You know, fresh ideas, fresh beats, fresh lyrics.
Yeah. Because you've spoken before about the it's kind of a funny story in a way of trying to get The Alchemist, your producer, to give you beats while you were inside.
Yeah,
because it's like a whole thing. You can't just send music.
It's actually, Albert Einstein is actually like the fourth album that I dropped since I've been home. Fourth piece of music that I dropped, actually. When I was inside, in prison, it was hard for me to get beats in there, you know, original beats in there. You got to order from a prison catalog, and in the prison catalog, a lot of the music is bootleg, a lot of it is overpriced, and, you know, it's all...
Well, there's a winning combination. It sounds like crap, and it costs too much.
Exactly. And a lot of the music is just instrumentals that are out there already, like the best of Jay-Z or the best of Kanye West, best of Nas. So it's like, it's hard for my creativity to come out when I'm writing the stuff that I heard somebody else rapping on before. Yeah. I need some, like, original. So, that was a hard thing for me, man, when I was locked up. It was definitely hard for that, man. And then it's funny, because when I came home, I met this guy, man, named Chris, and he owns a company called SendAPackage.com, and it's a catalog and a website. And it's for, you know, inmates in jail. And they send food, clothing, you know, it got music in there, like good quality sound of music. And me and Chris been talking, and we put together a nice little idea where we could put original beats in the catalog where it's good quality also, so that, you know, inmates like myself that need that can have it now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So shout out to Chris.
We're speaking with Prodigy, the rapper, half of the seminal hip-hop duo Mobb Deep, and also half of this Albert Einstein production with The Alchemist. Let's hear a track. This is called Curb Your Dog.
I get it. You're a freak for embarrassment and pain. Like I'm a freak for this rap music. Let me give you what you need. My DOGs, the GODs, the rap is back. MOBB, have MP. Who rap NYC like QB? We vets, we not pets. You confusing me. My DOGs, the GODs, the rap is back. MOBB, have MP.
Who rap NYC like QB? We vets, we not pets, you confusing me. With the mother bums that rap, they nothing like this. They wish upon stars that they balls and get. Similar burn as us, who had a run like this? I pedal dope longer than Lance Armstrong and Trek. Alright, alright, okay, okay, you got dope. How many times you gonna say it? We already know. When we debate rap wars, money and plaques is not a factor. Let us hear the roar that you wrote or curb your mouth, you muzzle that jaw. You ain't saying there that we wanna hear. Take a walk.
That is called Curb Your Dog. It is one of the tracks from the album by Prodigy, who's my guest on Soundcheck. And the producer Alchemist, I like the clarinets, and is that a bassoon in there too?
It's like Alchemist is like a mad scientist. That's why we call him the Alchemist.
So the record's called Albert Einstein from Prodigy on the infamous record label, and on the infamous imprint is Prodigy's book called HNIC, a novella sort of ripped from the streets. I mean, the story of Pappy and Black and Tanya, did you see that kind of thing played out constantly growing up in the projects?
Yeah, I've definitely seen real-life situations where friends turn on each other and, you know, sometimes they'll act like your friend and then they'll end up, they was just fooling you. They was just, like, trying to bait you into a situation. Yeah, I've seen that. I've been in situations like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you also, I mean, as if growing up with all this around you wasn't challenging enough, you grew up with sickle cell anemia, so you weren't able to, like, get out there. You didn't have the outlet of, like, sports, basketball, football, stuff like that.
Yeah, I wasn't able to do the activities as other kids. Sickle cell, you know, it's a hereditary disease I was born with. And, you know, the first thing that the doctor told my mother and my father was, like, he can't play any contact sports. He can't do any strenuous exercise and none of this stuff. So as a kid, like, they kept me real protected from that. They wouldn't let me do karate. They wouldn't let me do certain things. Like, my father was a karate sensei. Mm. You know, he had his own dojo. And he was, like, wanted bad for me to be in his dojo. But my mother was like, no, don't come on. He's going to get sick. Don't put him in that. So they kept me, like, real protected. So it was, like, once I got old enough to, like, get out there, I was just, like, running wild. And then just running wild like that, it slowed me down. Like, whoa, I can't do certain things. I had to learn my disease, like what I can't do, what I can't do. I had to learn my body, like, you know, the amount of pressure my body can take. You know what I mean? And I learned just through studying and through growing up that diet is everything. Like, if I just switch my diet to, like, green vegetables and water and healthy foods, I don't get sick at all.
Now, that sounds like a conclusion that probably took you a long, hard road to get to.
It did. Because growing up, you know, I was, like I said, once I was able to get out the house and have my freedom, I was running wild. Man, I was drinking liquor every day, smoking, wild. And then I felt the effects of it. My other friends, they could just constantly go like rock stars. So I had to learn, like, all right, I'm definitely different than everybody else. You know what I mean? And, I got to do things differently. So it took me a long time to really actually discover, like, oh, it's the diet. And, you know, that goes for anybody, man. But, you know, we all need proper diet, you know, and we will all see that change in our body. And, you know, we will all feel better just from changing the diet.
Now, Prodigy, you going to do an album of raps about the the benefits of a proper diet,
definitely,
vegetarianism?
Definitely. I throw that in the music. If you listen to a lot of my songs, they got that type of information in there, like about diet and lifestyle and spirituality, all that stuff. I mix it up in the music.
Marble and pillars, living like the Pharaoh Tut. I'm blessed with life, so I breathe deep and give praise to the Most High. Then I get fresh for a new day. I eat broccoli for breakfast, then smoke my trees. Turn on the flat screen to C-SPAN, city elite strength. Attorney General, slowly getting bills passed. Prophecies coming to pass. We gotta survive this done. It's nothing to laugh at. I hops in the V, grab the heat, and I stash that.
We're speaking with Prodigy, half of the hardcore East Coast hip hop duo Mobb Deep. And so you and Havoc are now Mobb Deep again, you know? There's a tour coming up in August.
We just did a U.S. run in June for the whole month of June. Now we're gonna do August and September.
And will there be another record?
Yeah, we're working on it now, actually. Like, maybe almost like 85% done, I say.
Now, what does Havoc think when you come in and you start rapping about diet and
he understands
diet and exercise and God and all, you know?
He gets it. He gets it, you know what I mean? I turned Havoc on to a lot of things, you know what I mean? And after a while he was like, "Yo, remember that what you told me? Yo, you right. I was looking through some research, I saw a video, I saw this." I'm like, yeah, man, it's real.
We're speaking with Prodigy, half of the hardcore East Coast hip-hop duo Mobb Deep. Back in 1995, they released their album The Infamous, and this was the big song from it called Shook Ones, Part 2. While they still alive, I don't know, go figure. Meanwhile, back in Queens, the realness and foundation. If I die, I couldn't choose a better location. When the slugs penetrate, you feel a burning sensation. Getting closer to God in a tight situation now. Take these words home and think it through. Or the next rhyme I write might be about you. Son, they shook. This ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look. They shook. This ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Shook Ones, Part 2 from Mobb Deep, featuring my guest Prodigy and your longtime partner Havoc.
Yep.
That's from the 1995 album The Infamous.
Classic.
It is a classic. Now, Infamous is the name of your record label, the name of the imprint that the new book, the novella, is out on. Again, the book is called HNIC. There's also the autobiography, which I think I mentioned earlier as well.
My Infamous Life, that's the name of the
Infamous Life. Beginning there in the Queensbridge housing projects where you grew up, Havoc grew up, Nas grew up, a lot of people came out of there. There was something in the water there. May not have been very good for you. But
yeah, it's a big neighborhood, man. You know, I'm not actually from Queensbridge, but I lived out there for a few years. I came out there about when I met Havoc, my partner, about 92, 91. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, even my father's mother, my whole family is from South Jamaica, Queens.
Oh, okay.
The projects out there, South Jamaica projects. And my mother's mother actually moved to Ravenswood, which is down the block from Queensbridge. So I used to always be out there growing up. And my mother used to work for the Housing Authority.
Right.
So she worked in a lot of projects in New York. And Queensbridge was one of them when I was a kid. So I used to go to summer camp in Queensbridge and all that. So it's kind of crazy how as a kid I went to summer camp out there. And then later on in life I met Havoc and I seen a lot of the people that I knew from like camp.
And another person who grew up there. The former Ron Artest.
Ron.
Now Meta World Peace, yeah. Playing for the New York Knicks. And you guys, did you know him in the neighborhood?
Or yeah.
You did?
Yeah, we used to go to his games when he played for St. John's. We used to go root for him. And then I remember when he went with the Bulls, we went to Chicago, did a lot of parties with him. You know, we were proud of him, man. Definitely. We were proud of each other. Like, he was proud of us just like we were proud of him.
Yeah. Now, you're sitting here with your New York Mets cap on, which I'll let slide as a lifelong Yankee fan. are you a Knicks fan?
Actually, it's just for the color. It matched my sneakers.
I didn't realize we needed video for this interview. Prodigy's my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. So what have you and Meta World Peace and a cast of thousands put together here?
It's called Blood in My Gatorade. He sent it to me, right? He's like, "Yo, P, I need you to hop on this song." So I said, "All right, let me check it out." I seen the title. I was like...
So it's his title.
Yeah, he came up with it. It was his idea. I was like, okay, I kind of like it because I could relate to what he's saying. You know, he plays the game real rough. He's real aggressive. So it got an aggressive title to it.
Right.
Like, so, you know, it fit with our character, our image. Like.
Well, let's hear a little bit. This is Meta World Peace of the New York Knicks with my guest Prodigy and a bunch of others and a song called Blood in My Gatorade. Block that I came from, mom that I came from. Told me stay tough, always move forward, never back up. Stay hustling, blood in my water cup, blood in my Gatorade. Yeah, drink it up. We adapt to survive. Clap at a guy, they call it eye for an eye. This is a very strange life. People wanna know why I act like I say it's blood in my Gatorade. I was raised different. That's called Blood in My Gatorade. That's a good track.
You know what I mean? Get you hyped before the game. Go out there and win, you know?
Meta World Peace, who will be applying his trade here in New York for the Knicks this season with my guest, Prodigy. Half of the duo Mobb Deep, and Mobb Deep back in the studio later this year.
Yep.
New record. In the meantime, there's your record Prodigy with The Alchemist called Albert Einstein. Congratulations on the novella, the record, and thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, man.
Up next, the husband and wife team of Carla Kilstead and Matthias Bossi are founding members of bands like Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum and Tin Hat. But their latest project is Rabbit Rabbit. They'll be here in the studio to play some of their music next on Soundcheck.
This is all that's left of my boat, she said. This is all that's left.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Rabbit Rabbit is the name of this new project from the husband and wife team of Carla Kilstead and Matthias Bossi. Both are composers, singers, and multi-instrumentalists. You may know Carla from her work with the band Tin Hat, and Matthias played drums in Skeleton Key and Book of Knots. Now they're releasing a brand new record as Rabbit Rabbit, and it's called Rabbit Rabbit Radio Volume 1. We'll hear why in a moment, but first, let's hear a song. This is Rabbit Rabbit with Hush Hush, live on Soundcheck.
Everything is hush, hush. The colors here have all but gone. Hush, hush. Everyone is hush, hush. The crickets sound a tintinnabulation of urgent alarms. Thank you. survivors in the eaves. Every look you send my way hovers in the rafters, and it all
is called Hush Hush, live performance here in the Soundcheck studio from the two members of Rabbit Rabbit, Matthias Bossi playing percussion and piano, and Carla Kilstead doing the vocals and playing the violin. Hush Hush comes from their album Rabbit Rabbit Radio Volume 1, which comes out on August 6th. Matthias, Carla, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thanks, John.
So, the last thing either of you needed was another band, and yet here we are. Carla, you've got Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum and Tin Hat and Matthias Book of Knots and Skeleton Key and all the rest. So what was the impetus for this?
Well, Matthias and I were actually both in Sleepy Time together, and it officially is no longer. So, and Two Foot Yard is also no longer, and Tin Hat is a spread out entity across both coasts, and so it is only it's not as frequent a collaboration as it once was when we were all living not under one roof but in one city. So it's the great churning of the soil.
We also essentially removed ourselves from society 3 years ago, moving to Cape Cod.
Moving to Cape Cod, yes.
There we were out on the beautiful, lonely expanse of beach and saying, well, you know, we better write some music together.
Yeah.
It's going to become The Shining otherwise.
So now, every month for the past year, I and a number of other people who subscribe to Rabbit Rabbit Radio have gotten a monthly song, along with, you know, little films and photos and stuff like that. So every month, the two of you have to write and record and produce a new song, right?
We have created for ourselves our own, our very own custom-built gerbil wheel. yeah, there's a tradition in New England of saying rabbit, rabbit on the first of every month. Before,
yeah, where does that come from? Do you know?
Old England, I believe, John. Mm-hmm. That's where most of
so
our
New England traditions
come from.
And it's like a superstition, supposed to bring good luck or something?
Absolutely superstitious. You can see I do have a tattoo on my right arm of someone with his fingers crossed. So I'm as superstitious as they come. Yeah, it's supposed to be the first thing out of your mouth upon waking, before anything else crosses your lips on the first of every month.
You're supposed to say rabbit,
rabbit. Rabbit, rabbit. And
it is harder than you might imagine.
It is.
There are so many utterances, especially if your child wakes up at, you know, when does the morning start? You have to answer that question of, like, if she wakes up at 2 and has to pee.
No.
Does that count?
That does not count. That does not count.
That's still the night before.
That's still the night before, yeah. So that gave us the idea of this monthly subscription of, so every on the first of every month, we share the luck, basically.
Right. So the first of every month in the morning comes this email with the link for that month's song. And so now you've collected the first year's worth on this
CD.
Album.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah, we're actually 7 months into volume 2.
I was just going to say, you must be pretty well along.
It took us some time to get the bespoke artwork together for the actual release of the first year. Uh-huh. And we were militant about saying, you know, we can't choose. We have to have every single song that came out in that first year on the release. So it's quite a journey through music.
Yeah. Is it also a kind of response to the way the music world has changed so dramatically in the last 10 years?
For sure. I mean, it's no secret that, I mean, it's on everyone's lips and everyone's minds. Like, how do we approach this now when no one pays for music? No one thinks they should have to pay for music. You talk to, like, a 15-year-old and they think you're crazy for actually buying anything. And, of course, they also haven't lived in the real world and they don't understand the economy of being a functioning adult in a in a world that functions on money. So that it really is our way of really owning what we do and getting people to kind of invest in that. And also, eventually, the financial equation of it, I have to be, maybe I shouldn't be so revealing, but the financial equation of it doesn't work yet.
Oh, come on. We're in the black.
We're in the black by about like $87 or so.
No, you know, but it pays for itself.
And the next song called In the Dead of Night, Matthias, what occasioned this song?
I was reading a book last summer called Empire of the Summer Moon by S.C. Gwynne about a young gal with cornflower blue eyes named Cynthia Ann Parker, who was kidnapped by Comanche Indians in 1836, and she became known as the White Squaw and spent 24 years in captivity with them, was against her will, stolen back from the Comanche tribe that she had assimilated into in 1860. In that time, she birthed a son named Quanah, who became the most notorious and powerful Comanche chief of all time. And this song is inspired by her, like I said, assimilation into the Comanche culture.
Ah, all right. Let's hear it. It's called In the Dead of Night. And it's another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio from the two members of Rabbit Rabbit. The album, Rabbit Rabbit Radio Volume 1, comes out on August 6th. And Carla Kilstedt, Matthias Bossi, violin and keyboard / percussion respectively. Carla singing as well. And the song is called In the Dead of Night.
In the dead of night, two worlds collide. says arrive. Took my sister, took my son, mother, father, everyone. In the dead of night we did ride. In the dead of night blood fills my eyes. In the dead of night my own family I deny. Leave my saddle, leave my gun, now the life I knew is done. In the dead of night we will ride.
In the Dead of Night, the name of that song, performed live by the two members of Rabbit Rabbit, Carla Kilstead, voice and violin, and Matthias Bossi, voice and piano. And Matthias, it's July, so I've gotten my email for the July song.
Absolutely.
Is there a typical way these songs happen? Or?
Well, this one actually came about In a wonderful set of circumstances. Last month, a musical hero of ours, Tony Levin, bass player, who is a longtime fan of Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, our old band, had done a little YouTube series called Three Pieces, where he highlighted some of the music that has influenced him. As a matter of fact, his band Stickmen covered a Sleepy Time song, Sleep Is Wrong, and he used this song as one of his examples. We took the opportunity to thank him, sent him an email, and he responded, knowing somehow that we are now living on Cape Cod. He sent me a picture of a whale tail. Turns out he was going to be vacationing there, as he does every year. And I said, well, Tony, why don't you come record with us in the studio? I didn't know what we were going to do. So he said yes, and I frantically wrote this song.
So then he had like 3 days to write a song.
I wrote a song in 3 days, and he came and... It was so fun. I mean, he's such a gentleman and such an absolute shredder. But in an understated way for this song, I mean, he really,
For folks who don't, who are thinking, Tony Levin, I know that name. Bass player for King Crimson, Peter Gabriel, list goes on.
The list goes on.
The album is called Rabbit Rabbit Radio, Volume 1. It's out on August 6th. Garla, Matthias, great to see the two of you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much, John.
Certain roads, certain people, certain they know me. I always take what they give me gladly, sadly. Never gonna go back home. I shot a bird and I watched him die. Nobody cried when I lost my mind this time. I'm the king of disaster. I should have asked her. So I'll run away. I'm never gonna come back home.
That's Rabbit Rabbit's song, Paper Prison. You can hear an extra song that the duo recorded live right here in our studio on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, while more and more musicians and bands are pursuing independent musical careers these days where they release their own music, like the band we just heard, Rabbit Rabbit, it's still common for some bands to sign contracts with a record label. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those labels will put out your music. We'll hear why next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Throughout the history of the music business, a record label contract has been the holy grail of the professional musician. Even today, as digital tools give musicians the ability to record and distribute their own material, a record label can still unlock doors for a budding artist. Being on a record label means your fans will hear your music, right? Right? Well, not always. Sometimes your album ends up on the shelf. And I don't mean your fans' shelf. I mean a shelf in the basement of your record label. The website BuzzFeed recently ran a story called What It's Like When a Label Won't Release Your Album. It was written by Aylin Zafar, and she joins us here in the Soundcheck studio. Aylin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So why would a label not release an album? Isn't that why they're in business to begin with?
Yeah, it sounds counterintuitive. They would want to sell the record, you would think.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, the most common reason is industry politics. So what's happened is, since 1998, the music industry has just been essentially collapsing in a way. I mean, there used to be six major labels. Now there's just three.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every year there's a different merger, there's a different acquisition. And so artists just get kind of caught in limbo when this is happening.
Is that what happened to JoJo, who's like one of the critical examples in your article?
Right. Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, her case is very extreme. There's a lot more at play there. But definitely, I mean, a lot of what happened with her was industry politics in terms of not being able to find distributors. She was on Blackground Records, which is kind of a questionable record label to begin with.
Mm.
But yeah, they were not able to secure distribution for any extended period of time. So
set up her story for us. Who,
right.
Who is JoJo? I mean, she had kind of a hit.
Yeah.
So you would think people would be falling all over themselves to release more by her.
Yeah, I mean, she was blowing up. She was signed when she was 12 years old. When she was 13, I think this was in 2004, she had a number one hit. So she became the youngest person ever to have a Hot 100 hit. She was on the rise. I mean, her voice was just big and powerful, and you couldn't believe it was coming out of this little girl who had so much confidence. So it only seemed like things were going to blow up for her as she was, you know, aging into a young woman. But, you know, as 2006 came out, that was her sophomore album, and everyone was waiting for her third album to come out and just never released. And that's actually what got me interested. Like, where has JoJo been all these years? She's she should have been on the level of, you know, Rihanna, maybe even. Like, you know, she could have been a big, big R&B star. She got caught up with Barry Hankerson, who's the CEO of Blackground Records, essentially cutting off communication with her. She turned in around 3 different versions of her album. She told me everything was done. It was mastered. There was the cover art. There were videos. And nothing could get released because they couldn't get the final okay and push for distribution.
So her record label had been sold in the meantime, had changed hands somehow?
Yeah. So, I mean, they were shopping around for a distributor. And finally, they got with Interscope after JoJo filed the lawsuit. She was like, this needs to change, and I really don't want to go to these lengths. But, you know, an artist usually has to kind of resort to that to make anything kind of change for them. And that kind of helped them get on the move to secure distribution with Interscope. But they were dropped after 3 years. So it was back to square one, basically.
Yeah. We're talking about what happens when a label won't release your album, which is this kind of weird limbo that this artist, JoJo, has found herself in. This song, Demonstrate, mm-hmm. is from that supposed third album.
Right.
From one of the versions that she submitted to Blackground Records, but which never got released. That's called Demonstrate from the artist JoJo, who had a big hit around 2004. In 2006, released her second record, The High Road, has not been able to get her record label to release this third album. Aylin Zafar has written about her story and like-minded stories in BuzzFeed with an article called What It's Like When a Label Won't Release Your Album. But we're hearing this, so it's somewhere, which raises the point that, you know, in the days of digital music and the internet, an artist has options to kind of sneak stuff out, right?
Right. I mean, she had released an excellent mixtape last year called Agape. So, you know, and I asked her, you know, what kept you from kind of doing this? And, you know, I think it's, you don't want to step on people's toes with going ahead and just releasing all your own stuff. But it comes to a point where you have the tools to do it, so you might as well just put it out to the people who are waiting and who love your music. And I think that's why the music industry is changing so much now. So many people are gaining huge fan bases entirely on their own just by putting music up.
Now, I mean, this is a long-standing problem. You know, I mean, musicians have complained about their contracts and their record labels since there were contracts and record labels. Is that changing? Because you do have people like, for example, Lana Del Rey, who, you know, by the time she came to sign a contract, had a huge fan base,
right,
you know, thanks to her internet work.
Well, I think that's what really helps is, you know, what happens is the way you get the most hurt by record labels is when you have no leverage, when you're an unknown artist and you're putting all of your faith in one person, one A&R guy, one, you know, label. And it's way better to go in with a fan base, and I think that's what artists are realizing. Lana Del Rey, The Weeknd, A$AP Rocky, these people built up huge followings all on their own and with their teams, and then by the time it comes to get a deal, they can kind of negotiate their own terms.
Although even in A$AP Rocky's case, as you point out in your article, you know, he had an album that was delayed and
right.
then delayed again and delayed again, although not for the same reason.
Yeah.
We don't know why JoJo's label won't release her record, but
right. I mean, A$AP Rocky is definitely one of those cases where it's the label waiting for the exact right moment to strike. He yeah, I mean, they saw something great in him. They saw that this was building, and they waited until the exact white-hot moment to drop the album. And they could have dropped it, you know, months before, but to really tease it out and make fans essentially, you know, begging for it, like, that's the goal.
So however much A$AP Rocky might have been sort of champing at the bit.
Right.
In this case, the record label was just kind of stoking the flames.
Right.
For
exactly.
An album that did do quite well. This song's called Goldie from A$AP Rocky.
Let's take it to the basis. You and them missed the greatness. My Martin was the Mason. Rock Margellas with no laces. Chris now go by the cases. Wait, hold up, that was racist. I would prefer the aces. Ain't no different when you chase it. A 40 ounce to chase it. That's just an understatement. I'm early to the party, but my Rari is the latest. Somehow it seems girls in their late teens remind me of favorite jeans. Cause they naked, cause you famous. Like some other ain't it. These other rappers, so tell me. What your name is, I'ma tell it to my stainless. You aim it for you bang it, but that bang it leave you brainless. It's just
Goldie from the rapper A$AP Rocky from right here in New York, an album that was done, it was ready for release, and then it was not released. It was delayed several times because, as Aylin Zafar has told us, the record label was actually waiting for the absolute kind of peak of interest in this much hyped rapper from Harlem. Aylin's article for BuzzFeed Music is called What It's Like When a Label Won't Release Your Album. Sometimes there is, like, kind of skullduggery involved. You mentioned Barry Hankerson, the head of Blackguard Records, which, you know, won't release JoJo's third record because nobody can get in touch with him or his label. There was, like, a lawsuit where he was convicted of, like, stalking his ex-wife and trying to blow up her car and stuff like that. But, you know, oftentimes it's just business as usual.
Right. And I think that's what artists are just kind of the most hurt by. It's, you know, being seen as a product and being seen as something that's ready for market. Those words are, you know, for an artist who really sees what they're doing as a craft, it's hurtful. And I think, you know, what you have to really, you really have to go into this business knowing what you're getting yourself into and having the right legal representation.
No, that's easier. I said, you know.
I mean, there's definitely, conflict of interest in terms of lawyers. Like, that's also, I think JoJo, she kind of pointed out, she's like, make sure your lawyer's working for you because they have tons of different relationships with these labels. But also, you know, schooling yourself. And there's all sorts of different little measures you can put in to kind of protect yourself if you know how to go after it. But
There's something called the key man clause.
Right. That's a really interesting one because it basically means that you can write in one person who, if they leave, if they're fired, you're allowed to walk. You know, they're your champion, so you're not going to be left abandoned.
Mm-hmm. When Clive Davis, the famed A&R man and record label head, was on the show, he talked a bit about contracts with the key man clause, where artists would ask. If he was signing, they would ask to put in the key that if Clive left the label, they could leave too. Then an even more interesting one and maybe more germane to our conversation here is the out clause.
Right.
Which is, explain
that.
I
mean, you can basically say, if you don't release my album within X number of years, 3 to 5 years, let's say, then I can walk. So that gives, you know, the label a bit of a timeline, you know, and you usually come to something that's reasonable for both parties. You know, they need time to sort of develop you or market you, et cetera. And, you know, the artist also doesn't want to just be on the label for 10 years waiting around, which, you know, like Sky Ferreira, one of the artists I talk about, she definitely was kind of, she was signed when she was young. I mean, I think she was like 14 and she's maybe 20, 21 now. And still has not put out an official album, but has just been kind of dragged through all these different images and, you know, different styles. I mean, they're trying different looks on her, you know.
So they signed her because they saw talent, but they weren't sure what exactly to do with it.
Right. I mean, I think they found her through demos on MySpace, and what she was doing on her own was awesome. But then when you try to put an artist in with who you think will be amazing for them, a producer or whoever, it kind of changes things.
Right.
And, You know, now,
now this being the internet age, you know, she hasn't stopped working. She just hasn't been able to put out that debut LP.
Right.
But there is an EP that was released.
Yeah, last year finally. And I think she has a new team. So she finally, she was kind of, you know, forthcoming on her blog and stuff about what had been going on over the years. And she finally found, I think, a good management team who really understood what she was trying to do. And so I think she's getting back to her original sort of voice. And it took off. I mean, Everything Is Embarrassing, the single she put out last year, just blew up. It was all on all the, you know, year-end charts and really well received.
So maybe not a happy ending, but a happy middle point towards an ending for Sky Ferreira.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that means her official debut will come out this year. I mean, now that she has kind of that force momentum behind her.
Well, you can read Island Zafar's full article for BuzzFeed Music, What It's Like When a Label Won't Release Your Album, full of strange tales of music made but not released. It's on our website at soundcheck.org. Island, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
The song is Everything Is Embarrassing, finally released on an EP by Sky Ferreira last year. That's going to do it for Soundcheck. Tomorrow on the show, Al Jourgensen, frontman of the influential industrial metal band Ministry, recently wrote a memoir detailing his rock and roll-filled life and, technically speaking, death. We'll hear all about it when he joins us to talk about his musical influences, medical mysteries, alien encounters, and more. Plus, musician and composer Jerick Bischoff recently released an album of orchestral pop featuring artists like David Byrne and Nels Klein and Greg Saunier of Deerhoof. He'll join us with an ensemble to play live. Join us tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.